So we're still doing everything possible to get ready for the Georgia game. I'll have normal meetings tomorrow. Everything will be on Zoom. We'll continue to do this. You know, Sark's kind of filling in my absence for anything that needs coordinated in the office. But we're going to do everything we can to help our team, you know, get ready to play.
That was Nick Saban, who naturally already had a plan in place for how Alabama would carry on without him after he tested positive for COVID-19. But it could hardly be worse timing for the number two Crimson Tide, who take on number three Georgia tomorrow in what could be the best game of this college football season. Today, how Saban's absence might just shift the dynamic of a one-sided SEC rivalry, and whether Georgia can finally get the last laugh. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Friday, October 16th. This is ESPN Daily. Bill Connolly, I asked our mutual friend Spencer Hall how I should be introducing you here today.
Oh, God.
And he said very flatly, Bill is the godfather of college football analytics, so I hope you accept that title.
I mean, I'm not going to say it was survival of the fittest. It was basically, I Googled college football analytics in about like 2007, and it came up with basically no results, so I started doing it. So I got to, I kind of won by default, but I'll take it.
Bill Connolly now writes about college football for ESPN. So, Bill, I was all set to talk to you about the rich pageantry, the backstory to what was gonna be the most anticipated college football game of the year. And then 2020 just got in everything. And so we're gonna talk about all the non-COVID angles to this game, but let's talk about the pandemic stuff first, because Wednesday evening, we got news that Alabama coach Nick Saban and the school's athletic director, Greg Byrne, both tested positive for COVID-19. So as the basics go, we are talking this through on Thursday afternoon. What do we know? What don't we know about Saban? And how much coaching can that guy do or not do remotely?
So we technically know the answer to that last part. If a coach is in quarantine, he cannot call in plays to the press box. He cannot communicate with the actual coaches coaching the game via Zoom or whatever. That is the rule as it's been laid out. Obviously, that kills any great visions of, you know, them wheeling him up and down the sideline with a little robot thing with a monitor iPad at the top of it. We don't get any of that, apparently. But the rules as stated for these special times say that you can't do that, and he will not be able to communicate.
And the coach himself, how is he feeling medically? Do we know anything about that?
Wednesday evening, when the actual diagnosis was announced, he said he had no symptoms. And his daughter at one point actually tweeted out, she announced very clearly, she had permission from him to tweet it out, that he was, you know, coaching the practice via Zoom and whatnot.
Okay, so that is, at the very least, some good news in a chaotic situation. But let's get back to that mini robot proposal that you had, because I was kind of hoping like Nick Saban would just appear on a projection screen somehow, like Zordon from Power Rangers.
We lean towards absurdity in college football. That would have been the best situation, but apparently not.
Apparently not, but like, could he theoretically just text someone on staff if he doesn't like the cut of the middle linebacker's footwork jib or something? Like, is there creative wiggle room here?
Well, I mean, in college football, there are the rules, and there are the rules you can prove you broke. So, you know, if he wants to text somebody in the booth, I'm pretty sure nobody's gonna figure that out. I don't think you have to give your cell phone up at the door. Maybe now you do. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure he could probably get in touch with somebody if he really wanted to.
So we don't know how Saban contracted the virus yet. We don't know who else might test positive over the next day or so. But it's also not the first time a coach had to sit out a game this season because of a positive test. I think of Mike Norvell at Florida State. So do those other situations shed any light on how this one might develop?
Well, yeah, I think so far, if I'm not mistaken, Mike Norvell's the only coach who had to miss a game. You know, others kind of, so to speak, got a little lucky. Les Miles had minor symptoms, but his team was on a bye week at Kansas when he tested positive. Blake Anderson at Arkansas State, he had a fever for a decent amount of time, but I don't think they played a game during that time. So it was basically Mike Norvell at Florida State. But the way college coaching works, you know, Sunday through Friday is kind of the bigger deal. And then Saturday, you just put the boat out in the sea and see what happens. So having a former head coach in Steve Sarkisian being able to take over, maybe that's where this really pays off, because plenty of guys still have lots of experience on that staff.
So Bill, do we have faith here that there is not an outbreak situation going on?
Well, one thing that Alabama has going for them is they are either the only or one of the only programs in the SEC that is doing the daily testing. So at the very least, you know, that's not a substitute for contact tracing by any means, but it kind of stops contact, if nothing else. You can more quickly address and isolate and all that. But the way college football has worked this fall, you know, basically a team puts out a press release on Saturday morning saying we are going to be without 18 players. Thank you. And that's all we really hear about. It really has been a share as little information as possible kind of situation. So it's something. I don't know what it is. It's something.
So as we sit here on Thursday, Bill, and we prepare to shove this boat out onto the water, as you say, let's talk about the actual matchup, because we do still have number 3 Georgia versus number 2 Alabama. And there is so much history here. The issue for Georgia is that it is so incredibly one-sided. We're talking about Alabama winning all 5 of the previous matchups dating back to 2008. So can you just recount for us what kind of thorn Alabama has been in the side of the Georgia Bulldogs?
So basically, when we talk about Alabama-Georgia, the current state of the rivalry, for the most part, we're talking about 3 games: 2012, 2017, and 2018. Mm. 2012 game was absolutely incredible.
We welcome you to Atlanta, Georgia, and the SEC championship game.
Georgia, if they win, they're heavily favored to win the national title they've been dying for since 1980.
If they're going to get 2 throws to the end zone.
Georgia does everything right for a large period of the game. They fall behind late. They're driving down the field in the final seconds.
12 seconds to go. Murray got it. But the clock is running.
That's the one thing he didn't want it to.
Chris Conley catches a deflected pass, gets tackled in bounds. They don't have a timeout. They can't run another play. If he had just slapped the ball down, then they would have had a chance for another play, but nobody would ever think to do that in that moment. So that was a heartbreak.
Game over. Alabama faces Notre Dame for the national championship in Miami.
They have to wait 5 years for another shot like this at the national title. It's Kirby Smart's second year. They win the SEC title. They get past Alabama in that regard. They make it to the college football playoff finals. This is their moment, and Alabama's sitting there waiting for them.
Raucous and ready for the college football playoff national championship game.
Two teams that happen to be from the same conference, but these two teams won in the playoff. They deserve to be here tonight.
And Alabama not only beat them again, but beat them in even more heartbreaking fashion.
In the first half, dominated by Georgia, 13-0. Tua Tagovailoa, true freshman from Hawaii, gets the second half start.
In overtime, second and forever, Tua Tagovailoa to Devontae Smith.
Tagovailoa fires to the end zone.
That was possibly worse than 2012, if that was even possible. And then in 2018, you've got another situation where Georgia does everything right for most of three and a half quarters. Jalen Hurts comes off the bench.
The guy who was replaced at halftime of the national championship game on January 8th comes in to take over for the guy that won that game.
And he had a brutal...
Georgia attempts a disastrous fake punt, and Alabama once again gets ahead and makes the title game that was supposed to be Georgia's.
Just inside the 16, quarterback draw, Jalen Hurts, touchdown! Another heartbreaking setback for Georgia. Jubilation on the Alabama sideline once again.
So the dynamic there is that Georgia has proven everything it possibly can under Kirby Smart, or most of it, but Alabama is still sitting there waiting for to push them off the mountaintop. it's always a titanic reason why Alabama beats Georgia, but it does seem like Alabama always beats Georgia.
Yeah, I was actually at that national championship game, Bill, the Tua Tagovailoa game, and watching the faces of those Georgia fans in Atlanta, it prompts the question now, does it feel like Alabama is just in all of their heads at this point?
Yeah, I mean, we know they're in their fans' heads. The literary element of the way things played out in 2012 and 17 and 18. From a team standpoint, from a player standpoint, it's probably fine. You know, 2 years ago, Georgia had a whole bunch of different starters. They're going to be playing a bunch of different guys now. I don't think there's going to be any carryover on the field, but there's absolutely no question. I mean, Georgia fans at this point are... Yeah, you know, they've had to wait 40 years now for a national title, and they've had plenty of heartbreaks, and most of those heartbreaks have involved the Crimson Tide, so it's in their head for sure.
So the thing that Georgia looks like it's going to lean on as they try to reverse this losing streak on Saturday is not the offense, but their defense, which lots of people think might be the best in the whole country. So what makes that defense so good, Bill?
It's funny talking about Kirby Smart, knowing his Alabama history, his history with Saban. This defense that they field this year reminds me so much of the 2011 Alabama defense that Smart was a coordinator for. They can rush the passer, they can disrupt, but they don't necessarily need to play that card. They just wait for you to show what you're doing, and then they gang tackle, they dogpile three 250-pounders on top of you on every play.
Under pressure, ball is out again.
And the Dogs snuff out another Auburn drive.
They just make it so hard for you to run your offense because they know what you're going to do. They're faster than you. They're all, you know, five stars across the board, basically. It's just a perfect combination of scheme and smarts and talent. They just don't give you many opportunities. And I even with Alabama's phenomenal offense, I'm not sure how many chances they're going to get.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you to assess that Alabama offense, that machine, because this is a strength-on-strength kind of a situation. They lost Tua Tagovailoa, of course, to the NFL, but the offense has kept chugging along. So walk me through some of these numbers that they've been putting up.
Yeah, I mean, I always say that injuries kind of hurt you in the present tense, but might help you in the future tense. Obviously, it hurt last year to not have Tua down the stretch.
And Tua's down. His helmet came off. This is exactly what you did not want to see happen.
Mac Jones, the backup quarterback, as Tagovailoa is attended to.
But Mac Jones got a lot more reps and looked really good. I mean, the line I used all offseason was he had a better passer rating against Auburn than Joe Burrow did. He had a better passer rating against Michigan than Justin Fields did. Like he aside from two bad passes, basically the entire time he was a starter, he was mostly brilliant. But those two bad passes were both picked off and returned for touchdowns against Auburn and likely kept them out of the college football playoff, or at least kept them from being seriously considered for that fourth playoff spot. So I think a lot of people were underestimating Mac Jones heading into this year, and I don't think anybody is anymore. I mean, his stats this year, 80% completion rate, like 17 yards of completion. When they fall behind schedule, he just goes deep.
Well protected again. Jones waddles, gets behind the defenders for another touchdown.
What a throw.
I mean, he's completing deep passes like 5 yard outs basically right now. And it's really, really hard to stop that when you can also run the ball really physically with a 230-pound Najee Harris.
Harris got a whole left side. Stiff arms the man at the six. Tight ropes the sideline. Touchdown, Alabama.
And Najee Harris has five touchdowns in the game.
So they really seem to have an answer for everything. I just, you know, I don't know what that means against a Georgia defense that also has an answer for everything.
So I was one of those people, full disclosure, who totally overlooked Mac Jones. And I feel like nationally, Bill, there is this notion that he kind of came out of nowhere to become this new star at the most marquee program in the country. So where did this guy come from?
Well, it's funny because... you know, he was a four-star recruit. Like, he would have been a star quarterback recruit for just about anybody in the country. But you go to Alabama, and you're, you know, you're behind Tua for a couple of years. You kind of get overshadowed. He committed in June of 2016 to Alabama and basically waited 3.5 years to see the field. So that right there, I mean, I guess says something about resilience and tenacity and all that stuff. But he's also got a good arm. He was a big-time recruiter, would have been for most schools not named Alabama, but he easily got forgotten among all the stars at Alabama.
Yeah, It's funny. June of 2016 feels like it was a million years ago to me.
For
so many different reasons. But I want to be fair to Alabama here. How much of this offensive success do you think is attributed directly to Mac Jones? And how much is coming from all of these other weapons elsewhere on the field?
Oh, I mean, there's no question. He's got the fact that he can go deep to Jalen Waddle and John Metchie and Devontae Smith says a lot.
He looks, has time, throws wide open, right side, touchdown, Alabama.
They lost two star receivers last year, big time receivers, and they had two remaining with Smith and Waddle. And then Metchie finally got his opportunity to shine, and he has 11 catches for 298 yards so far.
Jones sets, gonna go deep. Got a man.
There's no question he's got a ridiculous skill core at his disposal. There's no question that he doesn't have to do much for them to be pretty good, like Georgia's current quarterback, for instance. But the fact that he is good and can throw a great deep ball and can make plays kind of gives Alabama an unfair advantage against most teams.
Okay, we've talked about these two teams' advantages, their strengths. So coming up, let's get into the weaknesses that could haunt them and what the true impact of this game may or may not be on the college football playoff.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom! Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo, another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and Tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky, 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Bill, we just talked about Alabama quarterback Mac Jones, but I want to start here by turning to Georgia's. And Stetson Bennett, man, I got to believe, like, if you're born with the name Stetson Fleming Bennett IV, you are legally required to become an SEC quarterback. So this guy took a pretty non-traditional path to the starting job. How exactly did he end up helming this offense?
I mean, all the tenacity we just talked about with Mac Jones waiting his turn is like tripled when it comes to Stetson Bennett, walking on, going to JUCO, coming back. There was no reason to think that he was going to have a chance to start this year. I mean, there just wasn't. I write each offseason, I write a piece that I call like the 25 most important players for college football this year as it pertains to the national title race.
Yes.
The guys who, if they break through, they could have the biggest difference on the title race as a whole. I just basically said, like, insert Georgia starting quarterback here for the number one spot. But I very clearly insinuated that it was either going to be DeJuan Mathis or JT Daniels. But Daniels isn't cleared to go for the first game. Mathis struggles mightily against Arkansas. They have to put Bennett in to stem the bleeding, and he does so. And he continues to do so now. He's not taken many deep shots by any means, but he's not taken sacks. He hasn't thrown an interception yet. He just gets the ball out of his hands, makes safe passes. And while that is not very exciting to talk about, it works when you've got an incredible defense and good special teams. And, you take your chances when you get them. You don't try to do too much. He's kind of, in that sense, he's probably like Kirby Smart's ideal quarterback, even if the upside isn't quite where it needs to be. And I'm really curious now. There will be a time when Georgia has to make a play. You know, they're behind, you know, they're driving for, you know, 2-minute drill kind of situation, trying to tie the game or take the lead in some game. I assume at this point it will be Bennett doing that, but I wonder where in Kirby Smart's head, you know, the thought of, you know, well, maybe Daniels is the guy here. If that's anywhere in his head, or if he's basically saying, you know, Bennett's my guy for the rest of the year.
So what exactly is Stetson Bennett's skill set?
I mean, I think basically he's mastered the art of not screwing up. That is the art of the Kirby Smart quarterback more than anything else. Again, no sacks or minimal sacks, no interceptions. He's just going to do what he's told in that regard. And that is a skill. It might not be just that. He can make a throw. He made a really nice, throw a really nice deep ball to Kyaris Jackson against Auburn.
He's got a lot of time for the pocket, and he's looking downfield for Jackson. It's collected at the 11.
It's not like he's got my arm or your arm or anyone else's. He's got a college arm, but his best trait is simply making the right decision and not screwing up. And that'll take you really far with any coach, much less, Kirby Smart.
So there is this conservative style of offense for Georgia that you're describing here. And yeah, there's a ground and pound kind of approach, while lots of other teams around the conference are going aggressive, they're going aerial, they're going to this new modern SEC kind of philosophy to offense. So why do you think Kirby Smart remains convinced that risk aversion is the path to success?
I mean, there's no question it's in his DNA. It took Nick Saban a long time to finally say, okay, we got to open things up a little bit. And as he was doing so, Kirby left to take over his own program. He's a, former college defensive back, and he's a defensive coordinator by nature. And that kind of comes with that territory a little bit. But it is frustrating when you see the number of star receiver recruits that they sign, and then, the fact that they're not throwing too many of them. But there's no question that it works most of the time. It didn't last year against LSU in the SEC title game. It didn't in key moments, at least, late in games against Alabama the couple years before. And, it obviously remains the biggest question mark for Georgia moving forward.
I wonder then if there is any amount of, irony here in that Kirby Smart gets brought over from Alabama to get this program over that hump in a way that Mark Richt, who was his predecessor, could not. And yet Smart's been kind of in that similar or even the same place Richt was, with a really great defense and a running game and then question marks and hope.
I mean, what's been really funny is, there's no question that Kirby Smart has dramatically upgraded where the program was at the end of the Mark Richt era. But it's also kind of jarring when you look at Rick's first 4 years versus Kirby's first 4 years. They're almost identical, right down to, struggling in the first year, going like 8-5 or so, breaking through, winning the SEC, and almost winning the national title in their second year, taking a step back in the third and fourth years, but still being really good. It bears mentioning that in the fifth year, I believe, Mark Richt won another SEC title. So maybe that's a good sign here. But it is funny that they picked him to kind of surpass Richt. And so far, going back to the start of the Richt era, he's been basically tracing the exact same steps, right down to the almost exact win total and loss total.
And so now that Georgia offense, Kirby Smart's offense, it's going against this Alabama defense, which had a healthy and present Nick Saban last week and was still pretty porous against Ole Miss. Are there real questions, real problems that you diagnose on defense for Alabama?
Yeah, I mean, they haven't been I don't want to say, I think they were seventh in my defensive SP Plus rankings 2 years ago, which is my opponent and tempo adjusted look at efficiency and sustainability. I'm not going to pretend that that's horrible by any means. It's horrible for Nick Saban, but they've been kind of a step off the last couple of years. And I had them projected, 18th in defensive SP Plus this last offseason, because they lost a very, very high amount of defensive back talent. So obviously the guys who are on the field are all-star recruits. That's always the case. But there was reason to think that they might take a step backwards in pass defense, especially at the beginning of the year. That's exactly what we've seen so far. They're doing a decent job of limiting big plays outside of the Ole Miss game, but very, very high completion rates and success rates and whatnot for any defense, much less Alabama. So that right there is a problem. Now, the question is, how many of these problems that we saw last week can Georgia, in a completely different offensive system, emulate? Obviously, they're watching film. Obviously, they know what went wrong for Alabama last week, but a lot of it was aggressive passing downfield. A lot of it was tempo that Georgia doesn't really employ, or hasn't yet anyway. We don't know what they've held back for this game, but I do think that's the biggest question here is not only what problems are sustainable for Alabama, but what of last week's problems can Georgia emulate.
So the other very strange component to all of this is the fact that this may not even be the most important Georgia-Alabama game of the year, because in theory, Bill, these two teams will meet again in the SEC title game come December. So given that pretext to what's at stake here, how does either side approach this game?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is funny. I've seen Georgia fans already trying to figure out, okay, the worst case scenario now is we win on Saturday. And then Alabama fans can just say, well, it was without Saban. And then they beat us in the SEC title game, and we still don't make the college football playoff. That's certainly on the table. But I do think, in general, you know, if this was a situation where they were playing over Thanksgiving weekend and they were going to play again 2 weeks later, and you keep cards close to the vest and everything, I don't really see that playing out now. I would say that with 2 months in between, with both teams, especially Alabama on defense, a work in progress, I would assume you play the game. You show your cards, you do whatever you think needs to be done to win this game, and then 2 months later you reassess and you do it all over again. I think because of that time period in between, it's not going to be a situation where you're already looking to that game and withholding certain plays or certain ideas. You're just going to lay it all out there, I think.
So I actually want to look even further ahead than that next hypothetical matchup with you for a second, because also at stake here, presumably, is the college football playoff.
Yeah.
Do you have any sense of like what kind of a thumb this game is going to be on that particular scale?
Well, it is funny. We hear from the committee that they can take injuries into account in certain situations. Like if they lost this game, but they were playing without their star, we're not going to judge them harshly for that loss. Theoretically, you can kind of do the same thing now. Well, they were without Nick Saban, so of course they lost. Everything is so blurry, you know, all the criteria when you're reacting to a what is normally a 12 or 13 game sample and is now even a smaller sample than that, you can kind of use whatever criteria you want. But one of them is you can make adjustments for that. And I guess maybe that includes coaches, too.
I can only imagine how the message boards are going to react to that particular level of excuse making that you just described.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if Alabama loses on Saturday, Alabama fans are not going to count it. It did not happen. It does not count. It was not a real game. That's just the way it's going to be.
Bill Connolly, the godfather of college football analytics, thank you for making sense of whatever the hell we're about to see on Saturday.
Thank you.
Coming up, ESPN's resident sweet scientist, Max Kellerman, explains why the fight of the year could be happening on Saturday night.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home some huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Here's another story I want you to know. You may not be a boxing fan, or more accurately, you may not be honest with yourself about how much you actually like boxing. Because consider this hypothetical that a wise man once described for me. Imagine there's an intersection with four street corners. On one corner, there are some people playing pickup football. On another corner, they're playing pickup basketball. On another, stickball. And on that fourth corner, there's a fist fight. Which corner are you watching? Yeah, exactly. And so tomorrow night, if you're like me, you're watching Vasyl Lomachenko fight Teofimo Lopez in a lightweight unification bout at the MGM Grand in Vegas. Lomachenko might just be the best pound-for-pound fighter in the whole world. And Lopez, that guy is undefeated with 12 knockouts in his first 15 fights. And it's worth mentioning this too. They absolutely hate each other. But don't take my word for it. I turned to ESPN's Max Kellerman, the wise man who invented that hypothetical I just plagiarized, to dissect what just might go down as the fight of the year. All right, Max Kellerman, I am summoning you to ESPN Daily because this fight tomorrow night between Vasyl Lomachenko and Teofimo Lopez, I am super excited about it. It's on ESPN, it's on ESPN Plus, but for the sports fan who maybe isn't the hardest core boxing fan, tell us why this fight is such a big deal.
This is why you love boxing. Look, Lomachenko's the big favorite. He's supposed to win, and he's an all-world talent. Normally, a guy with those kind of fast twitches and natural talent doesn't have to develop the kind of technical skill that a lesser fighter has to, but he has both, right? He's totally awesome. He's one of the top 2 pound-for-pound fighters in the world, number one on many lists. And Teofimo Lopez, another fast, twitchy guy with big punching power and a high boxing IQ. Now, normally, look, Lomachenko's the big favorite, so what's the big deal, right? He's like a more exceptional fighter so far. Lomachenko's really a featherweight fighting at lightweight. That's 2 weight divisions north of where he should be. And Teofimo's really a 140-pounder, a junior welterweight fighting at lightweight. They're 2 to 3 natural weight divisions different in size. So the size disparity favors Teofimo and kind of evens out the odds. You'll have to tell me how to say that, Pablo. I think in the mind's eye, and creates this fascinating matchup of skill, speed, and power.
How did this fight come about? And how did Teofimo Lopez's father play into this?
It's literally a battle of the fathers. Lomachenko's father, he learned like how to train online, kind of, right? And then turns Lomachenko to one of the most skillful champions you'll ever see. And Teofimo's father, who's like a street fighter from New York and Florida, trained Teo since he's a kid and has been talking. You know, he writes checks that Teo has to cash. The fathers are totally different. Lomachenko's dad, totally reserved and quiet and modest, at least in public. Teo's father is talking smack like you cannot believe. And certainly Teofimo, with his performances, like practically decapitating people he fought, did the work, and here we are.
So before we let you go, Max, I do want to point out that you have also been in the middle of all of this, because as Lopez has been rising through the ranks, through all of these lists, he told you the following.
Your body can only take so much damage, and I guarantee you, we're going to put some damage to this man.
So what do you expect that we will see on Saturday night?
I expect him to give Lomachenko a stern challenge, but as the rounds progress, you will see the difference between, like in a chess game, between an expert and a master. It's subtle, small advantages accrued by the master, and I think Lomachenko will checkmate Lopez by accruing those small advantages as the fight goes on. I'll also say, Teofimo Lopez can end the night with one shot. Lomachenko has not been in with a puncher of Teo's size. The interesting thing to me about Lomachenko is he's a southpaw, so that means his head and the right-handed fighter's head are closer together, the way the stances work out, if you can see it in your own mind's eye, right? But you never see a clash of heads, right? Like, his head could be 6 inches apart from his opponent, and he's moving all around, and it always remains 6 inches apart because his mastery of distance and his footwork is so precise. He's always in punching range when he needs to be, and somehow the other guy's offense is usually thwarted.
And so does it feel then like the mastery of that distance, that sort of mitigates the threat of Teofimo's punching power?
Well, Teo is, when I say fast twitchies, that's usually what separates, athletes in sports. you know, you watch Saquon Barkley, right, or Zion Williamson, you go, oh my God, this is something different. And it's the same thing in boxing. Mike Tyson, Roy Jones, Pernell Whitaker, whoever, those are those electric fast fighters. Tao's got that. He's electric fast. And when that guy also has crazy punching power, he has chances in any fight. When you also have a high IQ, and Tao does, Lomachenko's given him credit for that. That fighter is dangerous until the final bell. It is a great matchup with great storylines, the highest level of skill, speed, and power. And I cannot wait for Saturday night. This is the reason you're a boxing fan.
Max Kellerman, I am excited. I am fast twitching myself listening to you break down this fight. Thank you for joining ESPN Daily.
Anytime, Pablo.
I'm Pablo Torre. This has been ESPN Daily. Our show is produced by Alexander Hyacinth, Mike Johns, Steve Martin, Ryan Nantel, Andy Tennant, Eve Tro, Chris Tumanello, and Aaron Vail. Special thanks this week to Kevin Woodson, T. Goriel, Rasan Stroman, Ali Bronson, Jason Costura, Russell Dinallo, Max Brodsky, and Troy Farkas. I'll talk to you Monday.